I thought it would be just another Saturday afternoon on Pearl Street, a solidarity walk, some photos, maybe a few quotes for the weekend segment. What I got instead was the smell of burning flesh and melted sneakers. I heard a grandmother scream, watched a young man crumple onto hot pavement, and saw an 82-year-old woman dragged away from a Molotov cocktail blast with her body on fire. They said it was a hate crime, anti-Zionist, maybe anti-Semitic. Depends who you ask. The attacker didn't run. He stood tall with a homemade flamethrower in his hands, eyes blank like he was already somewhere else. It wasn't a protest. It was a planned act of domestic terrorism in the middle of Boulder, Colorado. And it cracked the surface on a far deeper problem. How does someone go from a college engineering student to a man who plots to burn strangers alive? The suspect had a manifesto. The victims had only running shoes. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favourite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. Setup. It started like any other Saturday walk. Warm Colorado sun, a breeze that flirted with the American flags hanging from the Pearl Street lampposts, and the low hum of weekend foot traffic that gave Boulder its signature mix of charm and purpose. I arrived just after 11 a.m, late enough that the energy had begun to settle, but early enough to catch the first chants echoing off the storefronts. Run for Their Lives, a weekly peaceful walk in support of kidnapped civilians in Israel and Gaza. It wasn't a rally, no megaphones, just walking shoes, hand-painted signs, and hope. I was there for the local piece, a few interviews, maybe a human interest quote about interfaith unity. It was supposed to be one of those soft assignments. As I clicked on my recorder, I caught sight of Karen Diamond, 82 years old, dressed in lilac, short curls of white hair that danced above her shoulders as she smiled. She didn't speak to me directly, but she nodded in my direction. That kind of grandmotherly nod that says, "You're doing good. Keep going." I remember her shoes. Orthopedic sandals, one strap worn thin at the edge. She walked with purpose. I took three more steps and everything changed. At first, it was sound, a hissing, too sharp, too focused. Then came the heat. A scream fractured the calm, high-pitched and raw. I turned and saw the flame arc through the air in slow motion. It hit pavement first, then someone's backpack. The fire jumped unnaturally fast, crawling like it had an agenda. Then came the second one, this time aimed higher. The explosion was dull, like a whoosh muffled in cloth, followed by the stench of accelerant. Chaos exploded around me. People ran toward the nearby trees. Others ducked into boutiques, their hands pressed to the glass. I dropped to the ground, my recorder still rolling. Then came the most surreal moment of all. He walked into view, the attacker. Calm. No shouting. No declaration of belief. Just a man with a modified weed torch. Homemade into a flamethrower, he walked with it at his side, flame still active, scanning the crowd like he was looking for someone specific. But there was no target, no selection, just hate looking for a direction. The sound of sirens jolted everything into speed. A man tackled the suspect from behind. Another hit him with a reusable water bottle. Then more people joined in. One young man, face bleeding, held the attacker's hand down until the flame hissed out. The police swarmed seconds later. I crawled toward Karen. She was face down, her legs on fire. They pulled her away. I followed the gurney as far as I could, then lost her in a crowd of EMTs yelling codes I didn't understand. Someone handed me a bottle of water. I didn't drink. I just stared at the place where the flames first landed. Her shoe strap had burned clean through. By noon, Pearl Street was a triage zone. I counted at least 4 people on the ground being treated for burns or blunt trauma. Someone else had been hit in the face by a glass bottle that didn't break on impact. One child, maybe 12, sat wrapped in a metallic emergency blanket, whispering, "Why did he do that?" over and over again. No one had an answer. The attacker was identified on site. Mohammed Sabri Soliman, 25, Egyptian-born, US citizen. I scribbled his name in my notebook and circled it twice. Witnesses said he didn't yell anything during the attack. He didn't carry a sign or pamphlets, just a makeshift flamethrower and homemade firebombs in plastic jugs. And one of the bottles still had the price tag on it, from a local hardware store. I knew what that meant. This wasn't an impulsive act. It was bought, built, planned. I got my hands on the arrest affidavit that evening. The document was chilling, not for what it said, but how casually it said it. Soliman told Boulder police that he had been planning this for about a year. He claimed he targeted the group because they were Zionist. When asked if he knew who he hurt, he said it didn't matter. Everyone walking was part of it in his mind. Everyone was a target. He had duct tape, glass bottles, gasoline, a garden torch retrofitted to maximize flame distance, homemade weapons, with the casual creativity of a science fair project gone demonic. I tried calling Karen's family that night. No answer. I knew she was in the ICU. I didn't know if she would make it. The next day, I returned to the site. The scent of burned cloth still lingered in the brick seams. Community members had taped photos and candles to a nearby wall. One photo was of Karen, smiling, mid-laugh, in front of a menorah. Another showed a group of walkers arm in arm from the previous week. Someone had written in chalk, "Run for their lives and ours too." I didn't touch my recorder that day. I just sat on a bench where the fire first hit and started mapping out a question. What makes someone go this far? What takes a person from silent resentment to Molotov cocktails? What story brought Mohammed Soliman to that exact sidewalk at that exact hour with that exact plan? I didn't know it yet, but his digital footprint had already started unravelling, and the person I was about to discover wasn't just a lone attacker, he was a calculated radical, one who left clues behind. Chapter 2. Intrigue. By Monday morning, Boulder no longer felt like Boulder. There was a quiet, suffocating grief that lingered beneath the usual mountain crispness. The Pearl Street Mall had reopened, but nobody was really shopping. The chalk memorial was still there, and faded now from foot traffic and the light rain that passed through overnight. But someone had gone over the names again in thicker strokes. Karen Diamonds, most of all. She was still alive, barely. Third-degree burns covered over half her body. Doctors had induced a coma to spare her the pain of the treatments. Her granddaughter, Ali, had posted a short message online. "We are grateful for every breath." Beneath it, hundreds of comments, prayer hands, blue hearts. Then, buried in the replies, arguments, political poison, even here. I ignored the noise. I wanted facts, the how, the why, and the path that led to this hell. I started with the footage. The security cam video from Tandoori Kitchen caught the entire approach. Soliman had walked down 11th Street carrying 2 canvas grocery bags. His face was partially obscured by a wide-brimmed hiking hat and cheap drugstore sunglasses. But the limp was the giveaway. Subtle. Right knee, maybe an old injury. I made a note of it. In the footage, you could see the way he paused across from the walkers. He didn't hesitate. He didn't pace. He didn't fumble. He dropped the bags, pulled the homemade torch from a shoulder strap, and lit it. Then came the cocktails. Methodical. Calculated. Like he was rehearsing a sequence he'd memorized long ago. He didn't yell. He didn't chant. No manifesto thrown into the air. just fire. I spent the next 36 hours reaching out to witnesses. Some were too traumatized to talk. Others said too much, too soon. "I saw him lock eyes with Karen," said a man named Rafi, who'd been walking two rows behind her. He didn't know her, but he saw something in her face, like, I don't know, a target. Another, a teenager named Naomi, had recorded the aftermath on her phone. Her hands shook as she scrolled to find the video, but when she handed it to me, the image was crystal clear. "I didn't mean to film it. I thought someone needed to." In the grainy lens flare of panic, you could make out Soliman's face for a second. Just a blink, expressionless, almost serene. Like this wasn't an eruption. It was closure. Then came the affidavit. Filed by the FBI within 48 hours of the attack, it detailed the first interrogation of Soliman at Boulder County Jail. He was calm, cooperative. He told investigators he planned the attack for about a year. He said he'd spent time researching Jewish gatherings in the area and chose the Run for Their Lives walk because, in his words, it represented the Zionist agenda. When asked what he hoped to achieve, his reply was bone-deep chilling. "To send a message. I don't need them dead. I need them to feel it." The document also revealed a handwritten page found in his car. In it, Soliman described feeling betrayed by the country's tolerance of genocide and expressed a holy rage that had been building since October. The letter referenced Gaza, the IDF, and an invisible enemy, a phrase that investigators said matched language used in known extremist forums. I'd seen the phrase before, too, online, buried in threads moderated by nobody, places where anger grows in the dark like mold. I called an old contact, Rena Glazer, a counter-extremism analyst in DC. "His language isn't just anti-Israel," she said. "It's evolved into anti-Semitism and then metastasized into a martyr complex. That's a dangerous mix." I asked how a man like Soliman gets radicalized like that. She was quiet for a moment. "It's not sudden, it's slow, like rotten wood, family problems, isolation, trauma. You look for meaning, then blame, and if no one interrupts the spiral, you hit detonation." The digital footprint was next. Within 72 hours of the arrest, online sleuths had uncovered several Reddit and Telegram accounts suspected to be linked to Soliman. On one account, posts dating back to 2023 described the global lie of Zionism and the need to destroy systems, not just ideas. Another comment thread revealed admiration for previous lone wolf attackers. There were also encrypted messages with crude schematics for homemade incendiary devices, nearly identical to what he used. But what rattled me most was a diary-style note posted 3 months earlier. It read, "I walk past them, laughing, eating, pretending, and I feel the heat in my hands. I know what must be done. Let the fire speak." That line looped in my mind all night. Let the fire speak. By Thursday, Soliman had been charged with 118 criminal counts in Colorado, including 47 counts of attempted murder and 32 counts of assault with a deadly weapon. But the real twist came late that afternoon when the feds stepped in. The Department of Justice filed federal hate crime charges. U.S. Attorney Cole Finnegan issued a stark statement. This was a premeditated act of hate and terror targeting individuals because of their actual or perceived Jewish identity. We will not tolerate this violence. That wording, actual or perceived, was deliberate. It widened the legal lens. It meant intent mattered more than accuracy. Soliman didn't have to know who was Jewish. He only had to believe they were. That's what turned his actions from assault to hate crime. Friday, I received word. Karen Diamond was deteriorating. Her lungs had begun to fail from smoke inhalation and severe burns. Her family kept vigil while doctors debated surgery. I visited the hospital that night. I didn't go in. I just stood outside, notebook in hand, watching the nurses come and go. I imagined Karen's laugh from the photo, her lilac dress, the way she nodded at me just before it all fell apart. She hadn't asked for this. She had survived the Cold War, Vietnam, the death of her husband, and a battle with breast cancer. What she couldn't survive was a man with a torch. That night, I couldn't sleep. I kept thinking about what Soliman didn't say. He didn't beg. He didn't justify. He didn't claim insanity. There was no manifesto left behind, no viral video, no live stream. This wasn't for attention, it was for satisfaction. He had been planning to feel powerful. Not just make a statement, but impose fear. Real, hot, physical fear burned into memory. And now he had a courtroom waiting, a city broken, and a trail of ash behind him that no ideology could clean up. I closed my notebook and whispered to the dark, "Let the fire speak." Number, let the evidence scream. Chapter 3, Revelation. It was early Saturday morning, 7 days since the attack, when I got the first real lead that cracked Soliman's outer shell. An anonymous email arrived in my inbox. No subject line, just a few lines of text. "You're asking the wrong question. Don't ask why he did it. Ask how nobody stopped him. He's been unravelling for years. Check the CU archives. Start with his thesis advisor." There was no signature, but the IP address pinged somewhere inside the University of Colorado Boulder's private network. I didn't waste a second. Mohammed Soliman had been a graduate student in CU Boulder's mechanical engineering program from 2021 to mid-2023. His academic record was spotless, at least on the surface. Dean's list, 2 published papers on combustion theory, a pending patent on thermal conductance reduction in hydrogen engines. On paper, he was brilliant. On paper, he was invisible. I reached out to Dr. Lena Grossman, his former advisor. It took 3 tries, but when she finally agreed to speak, off the record, she didn't hold back. "I should have seen it," she told me. "But he was so quiet, reserved, smart, yes, but deeply isolated." She told me about the last time they spoke, 6 months before he withdrew from the program. "He came into my office and said, 'I've realized science can't solve what's coming.' That was it. No explanation, just that. He left and never came back. I filed a public records request for his university conduct history. What came back wasn't criminal, but it wasn't clean either. 2 disciplinary complaints. 1 for an outburst during a campus debate about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Multiple witnesses claimed Soliman shouted that Jewish media control the narrative and had to be escorted out by campus security. The incident was closed without formal charges. He agreed to counselling. The second was more disturbing. A female lab partner filed a complaint citing deeply uncomfortable political rants and threatening body language. That case was also closed. He dropped the course a week later. I requested the counselling records. They were sealed, but I knew what they meant. The unravelling had begun long before the fire. I dug into his immigration history next. Soliman came to the United States at 14. His family immigrated from Alexandria, Egypt, under a diversity visa program. His father, Farouk, had been a mechanical foreman at a Texas petrochemical plant. His mother, Nadia, ran a halal catering business out of their home in Aurora, Colorado. No prior arrests, no red flags. But there was something else. A sealed juvenile record, whispers of an incident at age 16 involving a suspended student and a homemade explosive device. The file was locked, I couldn't access it, but a former classmate of his, who asked to remain anonymous, remembered it vividly. He was obsessed with combustion. Not just academically, like philosophically, he'd say fire was pure judgment. We thought he was just weird. He paused, then added, I guess we were wrong. Soliman's digital life offered more clarity than his academic one. His Telegram history revealed years of quiet engagement with radical content, mainly anonymous chat rooms filled with anti-Zionist propaganda, conspiracy theories, and calls for decentralized violence. But unlike other extremists, Soliman didn't talk much. He listened. Screenshots shared by researchers at the ADL showed that he spent nearly 8 months inside a channel named Ashes of Empires, a group known for encouraging fire as political language. The channel's pinned message read, "When voices are censored, flames speak freely." That echoed something Soliman had once written on a forum. My father built oil rigs. My mother fed communities. I build something else now. Something that will be remembered. The turning point came in October 2023. That's when Soliman posted for the first time in that Telegram group. The message read, I'm done watching. It's time to show them that walking doesn't change policy. Fire does. That same week, Soliman purchased the torch used in the attack. Investigators believe he began making his incendiary devices shortly after, testing them in abandoned lots near the outskirts of Aurora. He didn't hide the receipts. He didn't cover his trail. Because he didn't believe what he was doing was wrong. I found a neighbour of the Soliman family who agreed to speak after some coaxing. She used to bring me baklava every Eid, the woman said, referring to Soliman's mother. They were kind people, proud to be in America. Mohammed was polite, but different. He avoided eye contact, walked with books tucked into his jacket like armour. I asked if she remembered seeing anything strange in the months before the attack. He lost weight, grew facial hair, started wearing all black, walked at night. One time I saw him staring at the sky like he was waiting for something to fall. She paused, then said, I thought he was praying. Maybe I was wrong. On June 6th, 5 days after the attack, the Soliman family home was raided by federal agents. I managed to obtain a search warrant summary. Inside, they found blueprints for incendiary devices, a journal containing surveillance sketches of Pearl Street, anti-Zionist literature in both English and Arabic, and perhaps most chilling of all, photos of the June 1st Solidarity Walk from previous weeks, annotated with times, locations, and handwritten notes like too crowded or better visibility here. He had been rehearsing. And every Saturday, the walkers had passed him, unknowing, unarmed, trusting. Then came the biggest revelation yet. According to the DOJ, Soliman had reached out, via encrypted email, to a known international extremist based in Istanbul just 1 month before the attack. The message was simple. The voice of fire will travel farther than the voice of peace. Watch me. Authorities were still working to trace the recipient, but it was enough to elevate the case into a matter of domestic and international terror coordination. Still, there was no evidence he was part of a cell, he was acting alone, and somehow no one had stopped him. Back at the hospital, Karen Diamond had slipped deeper into her coma. Her burns had turned septic. Her granddaughter, Ali, posted again. She's fighting, but her body is tired. Keep praying. I stared at the screen longer than I should have. Soliman had spent over a year plotting this. Karen had spent over 80 years building a life of compassion. And now they were bound together in a headline that neither asked for. That night, I went back to Pearl Street and stood where it all began. I counted the steps from the cafe where he lit the torch to where Karen fell. 47 steps. I whispered them aloud, each one, 47 steps. That's how far you can walk in a peaceful city before everything changes forever. Chapter 4, Consequence. By June 23rd, the entire city of Boulder had changed its posture. We weren't just grieving anymore. We were bracing. I walked past store windows, now reinforced with metal shutters. Police presence had doubled downtown. The Run for Their Lives walk was suspended indefinitely. And outside Boulder Community Hospital, someone had placed a white lawn chair with Karen Diamond's name stenciled in black spray paint. I sat in it for over an hour that morning, notebook on my lap, hoping for a miracle update. What I got instead was a text from Ali. She's slipping. The antibiotics aren't working anymore. We're saying goodbye. I didn't text back. What could I possibly say to a family who'd watched their matriarch set ablaze by a stranger for walking in peace? Later that day, I was granted a brief interview with Ali and her uncle, Stephen Diamond, Karen's son. They met me in a quiet conference room inside the hospital. Ali looked exhausted, eyes red, hair pulled back in haste. Stephen sat silently, clutching a crumpled prayer card with Hebrew lettering. When I asked them what they wanted people to know about Karen, Stephen spoke first. She never missed a march, even when her knees gave her hell. She marched for Selma. She marched against Vietnam. She believed walking could change the world. He took a breath, struggling to keep his voice steady. She didn't die because of where she stood politically. She died because hate doesn't ask for ID. Hate just burns. Ali looked at me then. She used to say, "You fight evil by showing up with your whole heart." That's what she did. They left shortly after. And just like that, the interview was over. But the heartbreak wasn't. On the evening of June 25th, Karen Diamond died. Complications from burns, sepsis, organ failure. The press release was sterile, factual, respectful. I stared at the official statement for several minutes before it hit me. She had walked into that march to honour hostages in Gaza and Israel. She had walked for peace. And now she was a casualty of war brought home. The very next morning, prosecutors filed new charges against Solomon. First-degree murder. The DA, Michael Dougherty, stepped in front of reporters at a packed press conference and made it clear this was not just an act of violence, it was a hate crime, a premeditated murder rooted in extremist ideology. And now, we will seek justice for Karen Diamond and the others he tried to destroy. He then paused, stared into the cameras and added, "Justice will not be silenced by fire." I followed the legal filings closely. They moved fast, almost urgently. The 118th original state counts now included first-degree murder, Karen. 46 counts of attempted murder, 32 counts of felony assault, use of incendiary devices in a terrorist act. And then came the federal charges. Hate crimes resulting in death and injury. Use of fire and explosives to commit a felony. Interstate communication of threats. Together, these charges meant Solomon could face life in prison without parole, and possibly the death penalty if federal prosecutors chose to pursue it. But the trial was months away. In the meantime, the public discourse burned almost as hot as the fire that started it all. The public response fractured into two distinct camps, each louder by the hour. One side saw Soliman's actions as textbook anti-Semitism, another in a long line of attacks against Jewish communities in America. The other side focused on his stated motive, anti-Zionism, and argued that conflating the two was politically manipulative. I didn't weigh in publicly. I couldn't. I was a journalist. My job was to report, not participate. But quietly, in the margins of my notes, I began scribbling words like false dichotomy, selective outrage, fuel on both sides. The political debate was overshadowing the human cost. Karen was gone. Four others remained hospitalised. A dozen more carried burn scars. And still, headlines were arguing semantics. I visited the memorial again. It had doubled in size. Hundreds of handwritten notes, dozens of candles, and one single photograph blown up and framed behind plexiglass. Karen, mid-laugh, arm raised, standing in front of the Boulder Public Library during a 2017 protest. Next to the image, someone had written, "She walked, we remember." There were people gathered, some sobbing, some angry, some quiet. One man held a sign that read, "Silence is complicity." Another simply said, "Run for Karen." A week later, I attended a community town hall hosted by the Boulder Interfaith Council. Inside, the room was buzzing with anxiety and grief. I counted rabbis, imams, priests, and activists, all speaking one after another, trying to build bridges through the smoke. But when the mic opened to the public, tensions ignited. One man stood up and shouted, "This is America. How the hell did this happen here?" A woman responded, "Because we keep pretending that hate crimes are just statistics until they're not." A younger man, early 20s, Palestinian American, spoke with tears in his eyes. "I condemn what he did, but please stop painting all criticism of Zionism as hate. That's not justice. That's erasure." Applause, murmurs, discomfort. I looked around and realised something sobering. Solomon hadn't just set Pearl Street on fire. He had lit a match beneath every fault line in this city. The following Monday, I attended Solomon's preliminary hearing. He entered the courtroom in an orange jumpsuit, wrists shackled, hair uncombed, no emotion on his face. He barely glanced at the crowd. His public defender requested a continuance. The prosecution objected, citing overwhelming evidence, but the judge granted a 2-week delay. As Solomon was escorted out, I caught a glimpse of something unexpected. His eyes, just for a split second, met mine. There was no remorse, no fire, just emptiness, like he was already gone. After the hearing, I stepped outside into the press swarm and blinking summer light. I opened my notebook and wrote only two words, "Scars remain." Because they did. On buildings. On flesh. On trust. Karen Diamond's name would now be etched into court filings, obituaries, and future bills on hate crime legislation. Her death would be politicised, debated, reframed. But the truth was simple. She died walking for peace, and for that, she was burned. Chapter 5, Spiral. By July, Boulder was no longer grieving. It was flinching, flinching at headlines, flinching at each other, flinching at the slow realization that this case wasn't going to be resolved cleanly or quickly. Karen Diamond's funeral had drawn hundreds, activists, students, survivors, politicians. But unity didn't last. As cameras left the cemetery, people picked up where they'd left off, arguing over definitions. Zionist versus Jew, hate crime versus terrorism, free speech versus incitement. And in the courtroom, something even more unsettling was happening. Solomon wasn't breaking. The day of his second hearing, the courtroom felt heavier, tighter. The air itself seemed unwilling to move. The prosecution opened with a revised set of charges: murder in the first degree, federal hate crime resulting in death, use of incendiary weapons in a public terror act, attempted mass casualty through flame-based assault. The defense entered a not guilty plea on all counts. Then came the twist. Solomon's lawyer filed a motion to suppress certain pieces of evidence, claiming that Solomon's initial confession had been obtained under emotional duress, and that he hadn't been read his rights thoroughly before questioning. Whispers rippled across the room. The judge agreed to a hearing on the matter. I circled one word in my notebook: leverage. That week, I spoke to a retired federal prosecutor I'd interviewed during the Capitol riot trials. He explained the tactic simply. When your client is clearly guilty, you chip away at process. You make it about procedure. You keep the jury distracted. You don't need a win. You just need enough confusion to dodge the worst sentence. It made me sick. Because what Soliman had done wasn't complicated. It wasn't theoretical. It was fire. It was death. It was visible. And now they wanted to debate how he said it instead of what he did. Outside the courtroom, things were getting worse. In downtown Boulder, a Jewish cultural center received a death threat spray-painted in red on its rear entrance. Zionists burned too. On the same day, a local mosque was vandalized, its front door smashed, and leaflets left behind blaming Muslims for Soliman's actions. The irony was inescapable. An attack meant to divide had succeeded, even in its failure. Communities weren't just traumatized. They were turning on each other, and still, Soliman said nothing. I turned back to the investigation, desperate for answers. Something deeper, something missed. That's when I got another anonymous message. This time from a burner Proton Mail account. He wasn't always like this. There were signs in high school. He said the world was already on fire. He just wanted to help it finish burning. Attached was a single photo, a teenage Soliman standing in front of a science fair project titled Fire, Nature's Final Word. Beneath it, graphs, formulas, and a disturbing quote scribbled across the bottom of the trifold board. You can't reason with decay. You burn it down and start again. I looked at the date in the corner. He was 16. That's when I realized Soliman hadn't snapped. He had slid quietly, slowly, purposefully, and no one noticed. I drove out to Aurora to try and speak to his family again. The house was dark, the front lawn overgrown. Neighbours said they hadn't seen anyone in days, but a package still sat on the porch, addressed to Nadia Soliman. Return address, ICE Denver Field Office. My stomach turned. I made a few calls. Within hours, I confirmed it, Soliman's parents had been taken into immigration custody. The DOJ had quietly flagged their case for deportation review, citing visa irregularities and a need to evaluate risk in light of familial association with a federal suspect. No charges, no trial, just gone. The move sparked instant backlash. Immigrant rights groups called it guilt by association. Legal analysts questioned the constitutionality of retroactive family-based enforcement. Even the ACLU stepped in, calling it an unconstitutional retaliation based on bloodlines. I wasn't sure what to believe anymore. Part of me wanted them out of the country too. Another part knew they'd done nothing wrong. They had loved a son. That was all. Meanwhile, Soliman's defense team changed strategy. They filed for a psychological evaluation. The claim, Soliman was suffering from dissociative radicalization disorder, a term I'd never heard before. The idea was simple. He'd become emotionally detached from reality due to ideological overstimulation, online echo chambers, and unresolved cultural trauma. It was bold, maybe even brilliant, because if a jury believed he wasn't in control of his actions, they might spare his life. I called Dr. Elias Green, a forensic psychiatrist who had worked with radicalized individuals. He wasn't impressed. This diagnosis doesn't hold up clinically, he told me, but it can sound persuasive to a jury especially in a case this emotional, if the defence can paint him as a product of algorithmic indoctrination instead of a willful killer, they'll muddy the moral clarity. I asked him if that felt like justice. He didn't answer. He just looked tired. By the end of the month, Soliman was back in court. This time, the hearing was closed to the public, but sources told me he remained stoic, refused all plea deals, and demanded to see this through to the end. One guard described his behaviour as robotic. Another used a different word, empty. That night, I listened to Naomi's footage again, the teenager who had captured the attack's aftermath. There was a moment, right after the second Molotov, where the crowd was screaming, running, coughing. And in the middle of it all, her camera caught something haunting. Soliman standing still, surrounded by fire and smoke, smiling, not wide, not manic, just a soft, satisfied upturn of the lips. The expression of someone who finally got what they came for. Chapter 6, Collision. August came in like heat off asphalt, heavy and mean. The trial date loomed, Boulder braced, and I found myself in the eye of a storm that no longer respected courtroom walls or yellow tape. This wasn't just about Soliman anymore. This was about what he represented. Was he a lone wolf? A martyr? A terrorist? A mentally ill man abandoned by systems? Or was he exactly what he appeared to be, a fire starter? The Department of Justice held a press conference. This time, US Attorney Finnegan didn't mince words. The government considers this an act of domestic terrorism, premeditated and motivated by hate. The defendant is competent, aware, and responsible. He spoke with a kind of rigid fury, lawyer's cadence, but something boiling beneath. We will not sanitize what happened in Boulder. This was murder. This was ideology. This was war tactics brought to a pedestrian mall. A reporter shouted a question as the press conference ended. Will you pursue the death penalty? Finnegan didn't answer. He just walked off stage. Meanwhile, Soliman's defense team filed a 48-page motion to strike terrorism language from official records, claiming it prejudiced the jury pool. They called it trial by narrative. They accused the prosecution of politicizing grief. And then came the real shock. They requested a change of venue. They wanted to move the trial out of Boulder County altogether, to rural Colorado, where fewer jurors might have direct emotional connections to Karen Diamond or to the broader conversation about Zionism, Judaism, and Middle East politics. It was smart, it was surgical, and it infuriated almost everyone I spoke to. The Diamond family was livid. Stephen Diamond told me over the phone, "They're trying to make my mother's murder a debate." It's not. He set her on fire. There's no nuance to that. But nuance, it seemed, was becoming the defence's only real strategy. That week, I requested a meeting with the prosecution's lead investigator. Surprisingly, they agreed, off the record. We met at a diner just outside city limits. She was young, mid-30s, sharp-eyed, the kind of woman who didn't blink unless she meant to. "This case is eating the department alive," she said.
"How so?"
"Everyone's second-guessing everything. Did we question him too fast? Should we have sealed the manifesto? Are we feeding the media too much? Not enough. We're bleeding trust." I asked what kept her up at night. She didn't hesitate. The idea that we win the case, but lose the story. The defense's psychological report dropped 2 days later. I read every line. They described Soliman as chronically disassociated, delusionally justified, and digitally radicalized to a point of ideological psychopathy. But buried on page 37 was something even more disturbing. subject has expressed zero remorse. When asked if he would act differently, given the chance, he replied, "No, but I'd bring more fire." That quote made headlines for 48 hours straight. It was too raw to spin, too direct to ignore, and it changed the stakes of the trial. Karen Diamond's family pushed for the death penalty. Human rights organisations begged the DOJ to show restraint. Online forums exploded, some calling Soleimani a terrorist, others calling him a hero. Pro-Palestinian protests erupted outside the courthouse, holding signs that read, "Judaism is not equal to Zionism and don't weaponize tragedy." Across the street, counter-protesters held photos of Karen with "Justice for Karen" in bold letters beneath her burned smile. I stood between them with my recorder off, my press badge flipped backward. I wasn't there to report. I was there to witness what Soleimani had torn open and what we, as a society, were now letting fester. Then came the collision I didn't expect. Soleimani requested to address the court, publicly. Not through his lawyer, not behind closed doors. He wanted the floor. The prosecution fought it, but the judge allowed a brief statement, no longer than 5 minutes. The courtroom filled to capacity, victims, clergy, press, even former classmates. I sat in the front row, 3 seats behind the Diamond family, and then he walked in, shackled, gaunt, face emotionless. The guard removed his cuffs. He stepped forward, cleared his throat, and spoke. "You call me evil," he said, voice calm, almost clinical. "But evil is context. Evil is whose version of history you read. I acted in protest. I acted against a machine that burns people slowly with sanctions, bombs, and silence." He turned slightly, looking toward the gallery. "I did not hate Karen Diamond. I did not know her, but she walked with a message I despised, and so she became part of the flame." Gasps. Someone sobbed. I froze. He continued, "If you want to hang me for that, fine. But understand, this wasn't rage. This was clarity." Then, with an eerie smile, "The fire isn't the crime. The silence before it is." The judge immediately ordered the statement stricken from the official record. But it was too late. Every word was already in the bloodstream of America's media ecosystem. The video went viral within the hour. Clips hit TikTok, YouTube, Twitter. Hashtags trended. Molotov message: Karen deserved better. Let the fire speak. This is hate. This is resistance. Soleimani had finally spoken. And his words were pouring gasoline on a city still smouldering. After the hearing, I walked past the courthouse alone. Someone had chalked a single line on the sidewalk, in block letters. "Do we still know what justice looks like?" I stopped, stared, took a photo. Because at that moment, I wasn't sure. In Chapter 7, Climax and Fallout. I thought the verdict would feel like closure. It didn't. It felt like the last drip from an IV bag, necessary but empty, after 8 weeks of testimony, psychological warfare, protest disruptions and press hysteria. State of Colorado versus Mohamed Soleimani came down to a jury of 12. And on a hot morning in mid-September, they filed in one by one. Eyes down, expressions flat. I could feel Stephen Diamond's hand tighten into a fist beside me. Ali sat with her head bowed. Then the clerk read the verdict. Guilty on all counts. First-degree murder of Karen Diamond. 46 counts of attempted murder. 32 counts of assault with a deadly weapon, 1 count of use of an incendiary device in an act of terrorism, 5 federal hate crime violations, no insanity plea, no mistrial, no technical escape. Soleimani stood motionless as the words fell, and then he laughed. Just once, quiet, unsettling. No joy in it, just finality. Like a man who knew the fire had done its job, the judge imposed the maximum sentence allowed by law, life in prison without the possibility of parole, plus 327 years in federal custody. When asked if he had anything to say before sentencing, Soliman refused to speak. Not a word. The courtroom stayed frozen for what felt like a full minute after the gavel dropped. Then Stephen Diamond stood and said, "Thank you," to the judge. No anger, just exhaustion. I understood it. Because this wasn't victory. It was survival. In the weeks after the trial, public attention fractured again. Some called the verdict justice. Others called it political theatre. The American Civil Liberties Union released a statement saying, "We support the prosecution of hate crimes, but we must also remain vigilant against overreach in labelling dissent as terrorism." Meanwhile, Jewish advocacy groups demanded stronger protections and broader definitions of anti-Semitism. The White House issued a short press release condemning all acts of hate-fueled violence without naming the case directly. And in the echo chamber of public discourse, nuance disappeared. I returned to Pearl Street Mall the following Sunday. It was quiet again. The breeze had returned. Tourists took photos with street performers, and beneath one of the old trees, the memorial to Karen Diamond still stood, faded now, but present. A young woman was lighting a candle. I asked if she'd known Karen. She said no. "I just wanted to say thank you for walking." That stayed with me. In the days that followed, more details emerged. Pieces the public never saw during trial. A redacted Homeland Security report confirmed that Soliman had been on a watch list for over 14 months, flagged for radical forum activity, but the flag had never been escalated. Why? "Low bandwidth," the document read. "Limited capacity to act on Tier 3 domestic concerns." He wasn't missed. He was ignored. And somewhere, deep inside the system, that reality festered. One final twist arrived in late October. Soliman's father, Farouk, was deported to Egypt under emergency executive authority. No hearing, no appeal. His mother, Nadia, voluntarily returned with him 2 days later, citing grief and shame too heavy to live beneath. I tracked them down through a contact in Cairo. They didn't agree to an interview, but they sent a single message translated from Arabic. "We raised a son to build things. We do not understand what he became, but we mourn every name he took from the world." I still keep that message on my desk, right beside a small square of concrete chipped from the corner of Pearl Street, burned, darkened, and cold. A physical reminder of the line between theory and ash. So what did we learn? That ideology can kill. We knew that. That silence enables it. We've seen that. That fire, once lit, doesn't ask who's innocent. That. We are still learning. A new sign now stands at the Pearl Street Mall entrance. This space is dedicated to Karen Diamond and all victims of hate. Walk in peace, walk in purpose, walk aware. I walk by it once a week. I don't bring my recorder anymore. I just walk. Quietly, carefully. Because now I know, more than I ever wanted to, what happens when we forget to listen before the match strikes?